Good evening, you guys. This is the TechNet, live from New York City. It's Sunday night, and this is the TechNet. I'm Dick, K2RIW. You'll also hear John, KC2WGB, Paul, WS2N. And occasionally we have a guest speaker, Hal, K6TPZ. This group of guys gathers the clan on Sunday nights, the clan of people who have curiosity. I want to know a little bit more about radio, wireless, antennas, feed lines, transmitters, receivers, propagation, lots of things like that related to ham radio, and occasionally some things about science that are not directly related to ham radio. But if you're a curious person, if you've got real interest in things scientific, then this is the right place for you. TechNet's been around for 31 years. TechNet number 1482 of the series that began way back in September of 1982. I was supposed to wait for those four beeps. It's supposed to be four beeps. I only heard two every minute or so. So when you get a chance to talk, make sure you wait first. Don't just talk immediately. Wait for the four beeps so the machine can reset itself so that the people in the outer areas that are signing in or listening by way of IRLP or Echo Link, they don't get timed out. The way the TechNet works is a sort of a schedule we follow that we've developed slowly, evolved over the years. Everybody's not always happy with whatever the schedule is. The current schedule is the first hour, hour and a half, our questions and answers of a general nature, followed by the mailbag, where John gets emails, snail mails, pigeon droppings, and whatever, that people who don't yet have a ham license or don't have the right equipment to be able to sign into this live net on Sunday night, and they send questions, and John chooses some of those. There was a period about a month ago, and John got 283 emails in a one-week period. That was because we had discussed one of the very interesting subjects, digital television over the air broadcast. Who would ever think that ham radio operators would think that that's such a mind-boggling question and or subject? But it was. Let me drop. So after the mailbag, we go over to Paul's space report. He tells us what the latest that National Aeronautics and Space Administration is doing. There's been some reports in the newspapers over the last week about the fact that their $17 billion budget is being cut back, and some of the great works that they're going to be doing in the future are now slightly in doubt as to whether or not they can be funded. After that, we go into deeper subjects for the rest of the night. And not always ham radio, but usually at least remotely related to ham radio and things with reference to the physics of propagation and radio. A person signs into the TechNet because he has a question or a comment. By giving us his call letters and his name and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. You need not sign in because you're listening. We don't need a great big long list of people who are listening. After 31 years, we make the assumption, we've made a leap of faith that somebody must be listening. A typical sign-in would sound like this, KC2WGB, John and yes. So do we have any check-ins right now? Give me your call letters and name, K2LIW.
W2RAY, Joe. Yes.
A2MU, yes.
K2MU, I got Joe, the first one, RYY. K2MU, you didn't give us your name, sir.
2MU, Bernie, yes.
Okay, so far we got Joe and Bernie. I did hear some extremely weak audio of someone else who was trying to sign in. It sounded like it wasn't a direct sign-in. In other words, it was an Echo Link or IRLP. So who was that other person? Give me your call letter and name right now.
Kilo, Foxtrot 7, Victor, November Hotel, Lance, yes.
Okay, Victor, November Hotel, Kilo, Foxtrot 7. We got you, Lance. And I think you signed in last week, and we went over to you. You didn't come back to us. Maybe that was KA7ZAU. What are you guys out there? Okay. Is there another person to sign in? Give me your call letters and name right now. I'm getting VBN, who's saying it so fast and not pressing the mic, waiting until the transmitter comes on, and then give us something number two VBN. Give me your full call, sir, and your name, K2LIW.
He's local, so let him say it again, and I'll listen to him on the input.
He said Freddie, Far Rockaway, VBN, and he's speaking extremely low. And Freddie, what's the prefix on your call letters? Something to Victor Bravo November. Freddie, give me the prefix on your call letters. K2LAW.
KB2VBN, he's in Far Rockaway, N2MB.
Okay, we got you, Freddie. And Barry usually pronounces that Far Rocky way. I know where he is. Okay, Joe, Bernie, Lance, Freddie, anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
WS2N4 with a space report. Good evening, everybody.
We got you, Paul. Okay, the first guy who signed in was Joe, W-H-2-L-Y-Y. We never heard from him before. That's a joke. Joe, what's the latest in your neighborhood? W-H-2-L-Y-Y, K-2-L-I-W.
Late check-in.
Pick up the late check-in.
Okay, who was late check-in?
Yeah, sorry about that, guys. This is Joe, number two. KC2, Queen, Yankee Whiskey, and the Mobile. So you could put me last on the list, okay? And thank you, guys. Back to the net. And yes, I do. I have a question.
Okay, QIW, Joe and the Mobile. Joe, when we finally get to you, will you still be in a place where your mobile has good coverage? How should we figure that one out timing-wise? Joe, number two, go ahead.
I'll probably be back to the home base. I don't have to go to work tomorrow. I'm off tomorrow, so I'll be up late. And thank you.
Okay, we won't worry so much then about whether you got coverage. Joe, number one, go right ahead. W-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-A-W.
Good evening, Dick, and I'm not going to answer your question about DTV this week because I know what kind of tie-up that would cause on the repeater system. I'm going to ask you a question about HF antennas, especially dipoles. A subject I brought up concerning this subject many, many weeks ago was the construction of a fan type of dipole, and you said you could do something similar to that by putting one or multiple lengths of wire over a single dipole to make one dipole actually work on many different bands. Okay, I did understand that basic theory, and I constructed a small model at a much, much higher frequency to prove out your theory, and it does actually work pretty good. My question concerning that on constructing an HF dipole is, which way do you start? Do you start trimming the higher frequency elements first, or get the lower frequency elements first? Because you've got to basically put an overlay of wires to cover, say, 10 meters, 12 meters, 17 meters, 15 meters, maybe 20, 40, and so forth, and then the full length was going to be an 80-meter dipole. Or do you trim the 80-meter first, get that one resonant, and then work your way upwards in frequency? Which way would you say that would be the best way of going with something like this? Back to you.
I'm not sure there is a best way, but let me show you what the interaction is like. If you built yourself a fan dipole on 80, 40, 20, 15, and 10, 80, 40, 20, 15, 10, that would be five dipoles, all with a common center, some reasonable amount of spacing on the ends, and the spacing on the ends could be done with one piece of catenary rope, if you know what I mean, with multiple connections between those egg insulators at the end and then one piece of catenary rope. As you create a greater and greater spread at the end, the amount of interaction decreases. You could, in the extreme case, and people have done this, have essentially no spread at all. They make a fan dipole out of the five-lead ribbon cable that's used for controlling a rotator. And there's no spread at all. And the advantage of that scheme is that you get the most compact possible antenna. The disadvantage is you get a huge amount of interaction. Let me drop. And the way the interaction works is that when you're tuning the 80-meter dipole, it doesn't see any of the others. It's so big, all those others are so small, near the center of the dipole where there's very little capacitive loading effect. So the 80-meter one, he's all by himself. The 40-meter one will be seeing the 80-meter one. So I guess, from that point of view, I would start low and go high. Because as you work your way up, the previous one doesn't even know what you've done, if you know what I mean, as you're working your way up in frequency. And one other thing going on here, even if you decided to do it in the reverse order, if you decided to tune 10 meters first, the 10-meter tips are seeing the wire that's local of the 20-meter dipole or the 15-meter dipole, the one that's closest to it, adding some capacitive effect on the end. That capacitive effect is almost not related to resonant frequency. As you later do some tuning, if you tune the 10-meter first and then you start tuning the 15, you're only making a minor perturbation to the tip distance on the 15. That really doesn't change how much local wire the 10-meter sees as capacitive loading to its tips. So from that point of view, it doesn't matter, Joe. Start high if you want to, start low if you want to. In either case, the amount of subsequent re-interaction because you've made a change of one of the other dipoles is a very minor effect. Each person who has built a fan dipole is usually very happy with the results because it automatically does switching. When you study the so-called Brown and Woodward curves, these are the curves of what resistive component, what reactive component you get out of a dipole as you change its length. Let me drop. And these are very valuable Brown and Woodward curves are in Chapter 4 of almost every edition of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, except for the first edition, the 1960 edition. It's in Chapter 3. But in all other of the five editions of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, Chapter 4 has a set of curves where you change the length of the monopole, and it tells you exactly what resistive component you're going to see of impedance and what reactive component you're going to see. And bear in mind that those curves are for a monopole. Bear in mind that every dipole is a pair of monopoles back to back. So if out of that curve you read 35 ohms for the resistive component for a monopole, you know that when it's a dipole and you've got two monopoles back to back, the 35 ohms is going to become twice that. It'll become 70 ohms. So once you realize that, and you can read about how to use those curves to come up with a perfect impedance match for a dipole by going to that article that I wrote that's on the Tom Williams page. You go to Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha, .org, yes, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha .org, Tom Williams microwave page. You go to the bottom of the page, and you'll find Yagi and Dipole Matching by K2RIW. And you look at those two curves, and you read that article, about 1,500 words, and it tells you how easy it is to make a perfect match to any dipole, whether it's the dipole all by itself in free space, whether it's part of a Yagi, whether it's part of a log periodic, whether it's the monopole antenna that's feeding a feed horn, doesn't matter. You can make perfect impedance match if you follow that procedure. Let me drop. The main thing I wanted you to see about the Brown and Woodward curve, Brown and Woodward curves, plural, is that as you make the monopole slash dipole a little bit longer, a little bit shorter, the reactive component goes from zero to something real big, real fast. In other words, as you knock it out of resonance, all of a sudden what used to be 0 ohms of capacitor reactance becomes 1,000 ohms of capacitor reactance, real fast. As such, in the case of a fan dipole, when you're on 40 meters, for instance, the 80-meter dipole is, it's in resonance, but it's the second harmonic. harmonic resonance, which gives you a very high impedance. The 20-meter dipole is way below resonance, and he's going to give you a high capacitor reactance. The bottom line of all this is that each of the antennas that are not on the frequency you're operating on have such an extremely high reactive impedance that they are essentially an open circuit. That's important. Essentially, all the unused dipoles of a fan dipole, when you choose some particular frequency, all the others are essentially an open circuit. Only the dipole that you're on the right frequency of is presenting a 73-ohm load. Therefore, 99% of the power goes down the right dipole and avoids all the others because they're essentially an open circuit. It's an automatic switching arrangement. That's what a fan dipole does. As a schematic diagram on a piece of paper, you would never see that. It looks like they're all in parallel. Only one of them is resonant at one time. Let me drop. And as you guys have heard me say so often, if you want an antenna to radiate, you make it resonate first, then it will radiate. If you don't resonate it, it will almost not radiate at all. To me, that's essentially the most important parameter of any antenna you're ever going to build. And the fact that those words, that very important concept, is not in any respected book, amazes the hell out of me. How in the world can all these guys doing all this antenna engineering for the last 150 years, and no one has come to that conclusion? Once you realize that you resonate the thing first and expose it to air, the wire of the resonant thing that the radiating system is exposed to air, as long as you resonate it, it will radiate it. It will radiate even if the antenna is too small. You take the modern-day cell phone where the antenna inside is being packed into an extremely small package because for dumb reasons, the designers think that people will not tolerate a little whip antenna sticking outside, so everything's got to be internal. Therefore, you force the antenna to be super small. As long as it's resonant on that particular frequency, it will radiate equally as well, efficiency-wise, as if it was a full half-wave dipole. Hard to believe. The infinitesimal dipole, built out of low-loss materials, as long as it resonates, it still will radiate 98% of your RF energy. You say those words on 20 meters, everybody will say, you're crazy. You actually go and do it, and you'll say, wow, ain't Mother Nature crazy. Ain't Mother Nature nice. I know that's some of what you're looking for, Joe. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Well, it's a help and it's a start, because I didn't want to start constructing this thing and getting it away on the left field where I start on one band and, you know, going on the other. But I think I'm going to start on the lowest frequency first of 80 meters, get that resonant where I want to have it, and then work up with. But previously, in the construction, I'll overlay the other wires, intentionally making them much longer than they need to be, whereas I worked up a frequency, all I have to do is trim them shorter, and I can raise the resonant frequency of those respective bands. So I think that order that should work out okay, hopefully. And as I get into this project, as the weather becomes a little nicer, probably towards the early springtime or so, I'll definitely let you know how it works out. Back to you.
Question. Yeah, let us know how that works out. Wes has a question. Go ahead, Wes.
Patricia, when we have an antenna of walkie-talkie, the body is the counterpoise to the antenna. When we have an antenna in dipole antenna in the car, the body of the car becomes the counterpoise. But here's the puzzle. We have a plastic enclosure of the cell phone, and we not necessarily hold it in the hand. I wonder how the SWR of that antenna changes when it's lying on the table, wooden table, or when you hold it on in our hand. Also, for the stability of the resonant circuit that is keeping the antenna in the resonance is being made there. And to see.
I think it was one of the latest issues of High Frequency Electronics. That electronic design news, one of the recent issues in the last 2 months talked about the fact that the company that builds the antenna tuner being used on portable wireless devices like cell phones is now making something like 50 million of these things per year. The antenna, no matter how small it is, as long as it resonates, as long as it is exposed to the air, so to speak, not a completely shielded structure, 98% of the energy will be radiated. But because in the case of a cell phone, sometimes your hand is wrapped around the thing, sometimes your hand is not there, sometimes you're holding it with two fingers, sometimes, like Wes just said, it's sitting on the table. On top of that, that, believe it or not, is only half of the grief the antenna designer for a cell phone has to live with. The other half of the problem is that as we're now going to Wi-Fi concepts, we're using LTE, we're using the 700 meg region, the 800 meg region, the 1800 meg region, the 1900 meg region. We're using frequencies all over the place. There's obviously got to be some kind of a tuner in there that tunes the antenna to the new frequency when you go there. They don't have the space inside to put five separate antennas for those five separate bands that I just mentioned. It's all one antenna assembly with an automatic tuning arrangement. The antenna tuner that you and I buy for our ham radio antennas, believe it or not, there is something equivalent to that in almost every cell phone you buy today. There is an automatic antenna tuner in there. I'm going to call it semi-automatic. Let me drop. Because when you go from service A to service B, and you go from the 700 meg band to the 1800 meg band, as you're driving along with your automobile with your cell phone in your hand, the radio knows which frequency band you're switching to, therefore it knows the course tuning of that antenna tuner. It gives that antenna tuner course tuning information that gets it into the ballpark. But that antenna tuner does have to do further automatic tuning, because you might be on the high end of the band, the low end of the band, your hand is around there adding capacitance, your hand is not there, it's laying on the table, and so on. That automatic antenna tuner has to do all that work. So there's millions and millions of these automatic antenna tuners. It's a tiny little integrated circuit chip-like thing being put into all those cell phones. And the company that makes those is, I don't know if he's making a lot of money, but I know he's making a lot of hardware, because essentially every one of those cell phones nowadays needs it. You can make the antenna smaller and smaller, and once you resonate it, it'll radiate nearly 100% of your power. But as you make the antenna small, it becomes extremely high in Q. That's a fancy way of saying very, very narrowband. You build that 80-meter dipole, which should be 132 feet long. You make it 32 feet long. You put the right kind of antenna tuner at the base of the antenna, or put loading coils, do all kinds of things to bring it into resonance. The fact that it's so small means that you QSY 50KC and you've got to retune. You're out of the resonance of that antenna. If it was a full half-wave dipole, it'll cover the whole 3.5 to 4.0 megahertz with an acceptable amount of standing wave ratio. You build it as 32 feet long instead of 132 feet long. It ain't 500 KC wide anymore. You'd be lucky if it's 30 KC wide. It might even be 15. And so you got to do some retuning. Because they squeezed that antenna into a very small
repeater. Time out.
Because they've squeezed that antenna into a very small package, in the case of that cell phone, they have no choice but to have one hell of a broadband automatic antenna tuner built inside. It wouldn't work without it. Once again, very strong piece of evidence saying you resonate first, then you can radiate. And once again, those words are not in any respected book. You guys who are ham radio operators and tinkerers with antennas in your backyard, you've got a piece of secret to the recipe the rest of the world doesn't seem to know yet. Everybody thinks that the only way you can build an antenna, because it's so complicated, you can't solve those equations, you go to some kind of a computer modeling program to build your antenna, and you don't know what's going on inside the computer program. And the computer program, I know that there are people taking a course these days being taught by Mike Cosma on use of antenna modeling. And when it comes to wire-like antennas, dipole-like antennas, Yagi-like antennas of small diameter radiators, those computer modeling programs do a beautiful job. But remember, the computer modeling program has a serious limitation. You build an antenna out of very large diameter radiators, like you could easily do at 900 megs. I'll admit that you can't do this at 80 meters. You're not likely to make the wire 10 foot in diameter on 80 meters, if you know what I mean. But you can do the equivalent of that easily with sheet metal if you're building a Yagi out of sheet metal at 900 megs. Very easy to make the equivalent of a 10 foot diameter piece of wire on the dipole-like structure. The computer modeling programs, for the most part, cannot handle that. They get you not even in the ballpark. They get you into the town. They don't get you into the ballpark. So there's a whole class of them.
Repeater, time out.
I'm very good at timing out the machine today. Make sure you guys don't do that. There's a whole class of antennas that the computer modeling programs cannot handle. They can barely get you into the town. They can't get you into the ballpark. The guy who knows how to tinker with the right kind of measuring equipment, he can come up with all kinds of extremely high-performance antennas that cannot be modeled. So, like everything else in the world, the modeling programs in the right application are beautiful. They do great things, but they don't do everything. And because almost every single major antenna manufacturing company and antenna development organization within the United States for sure, and probably most of Europe and Asia, they have a philosophy. They have developed an extreme amount of faith in computer modeling programs. As such, let me drop. As such, their whole philosophy of life and method of operation to run their business is they think, they say out loud, we model it first, then we build it. They never build an antenna they don't model. They are not good ham radio operators from my point of view. They're denying half the world of potential antennas because of that limiting philosophy. I'm amazed that they've fallen into that trap. And I went to a major meeting of the Antennas and Propagation Society of the IEEE, held at BAE, British Aerospace Engineering, it used to be called Hazeltine. I went to a major meeting 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago, that was on this one thing, it was December 8th, in which computer modeling was the main subject of display at that particular meeting. As I said, it was a meeting of the Antennas and Propagation Society. And I looked at the curves of the Smith plots, Smith chart plots that were being shown in that presentation. It went on for an hour and a half. At the end, I asked the question, how come these curves are so smooth? The real world doesn't do that. And the speaker told me that these are not the real measurements. These are computer modeling. To which I said, don't you realize that real antennas, when you try to model the antenna as a simple set of resistors, capacitors, and inductors, don't you realize that on a real antenna, as you sweep in frequency, the amount of resistance, the amount of capacitance, the amount of inductance does not stay constant? And the person looked at me kind of strange, saying, where in the world did you get that opinion? And my answer was the Brown and Woodward curves that are in Chapter 4 of every issue. Let me drop. The Brown and Woodward curves of real antenna measured impedance that are in every issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook in Chapter 4. Both the speaker and the other antenna engineers in the room asked me, what chapter was that? I said, Chapter 4 of every issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook. They had an inquisitive look on their face saying, what is this stuff? Is that something brand new? And I said, Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward made those measurements in 1948, and it's been in every issue ever since. And if you know what you're looking at, when you look at those curves, you'll see that the apparent resistance, reactance, and capacitance and inductance of an antenna does not stay fixed as you sweep in frequency. That's the real world. And you guys have been modeling, assuming that everything is fixed. Mother Nature doesn't behave that way. And so that meeting was written up as saying that there were some interesting questions at the end that require further research. That amazes me. At first, I thought these people were very foolish, not requiring real verification of what they were doing, a real measurement in a real laboratory. Let me drop. Eric recognized. At first, I said, these guys are very foolish that they didn't require any verification. A good guy who is in the audience, who I know very well, Jesse Tao, who was the chief engineer of the Central Research Department of Airborne Instruments Laboratory. Jesse and I know each other pretty well, and he told me that he's always amazed when he interviews a new June grad student who is doing all kinds of theoretical work, and somehow he has fallen into the trap of not thinking that anything has to be verified with a real-world measurement. He's always amazed at that. And I was amazed at the way these people, professional antenna engineers, were behaving. I said to myself, they're very foolish. I suddenly realized I'm wrong. They're not foolish. They are victims. They have fallen into the trap of the educational system by which we teach antenna engineering, at least in the United States and maybe in Europe too. They are victims. They have fallen into a trap of making too much of a leap of faith of what computer modeling can do. KE2EJ, KQRIW, go ahead, Eric.
Good evening, Dick, KQRIW, KQ. I just want to kind of stop you in your tracks and make you think, well, maybe a little light bulb off some of these guys' heads. Now, I've done a fair amount of programming and done some things that were considered a model in action, and there's nothing in the world to stop them. And you'll probably find a few of those guys that actually wrote their own modeling program from incorporating real-world data into their program. If you look at what the National Weather Service does, their advance in programming and modeling is totally dependent on learned experience. And with many different kinds of software that you can create, you can incorporate the learned experience, such as the Brown and Woodward curve. Yet, I mean, your description was actually a perfect algorithm that has to improve the modeling programs that they're using. And one day, you're going to have to stop saying that it doesn't, because it will, but with some caveats, because every antenna is different. And, you know, you probably won't create a program that does over 5,000 of them, but I just wanted to stick that in there. K2RW, K2J.
If I zoom back from what I think you just said, Eric, I agree with you. Every computer modeling program philosophy must evolve. I know it's going to get better. The things that I see as a deficiency in those modeling programs today, I know that some of those deficiencies will not exist tomorrow, because somebody's going to realize that, hey, in this particular situation, it doesn't match real-world measurements. Well, we've got to beef up the program. So it's going to get better. However, in my opinion, it's never going to get as good as what we ham radio operators tinkering in our backyard can do. The reason I say that is if you're smart enough to start making the radiators very large in diameter, where the frequency range is high enough, where you have the easy way of doing it. As I said, you're not going to do it on 80 meters. You're not going to make a 10-foot diameter piece of wire, a cage-like dipole on 80 meters. Very few of us are going to do that. But you can easily do that at 900 megs and 2 gigs and so on. Very easily make it equivalent, because it's only, you know, an inch and a half wide, so to speak. But it'll act like it's 10-foot diameter dipole on 80 meters. The reason why the computer modeling programs are always going to have grief with that is that when you make the radiator, and there's multiple radiators in some cases, let me drop this. When you make the radiator that big, the way the computer modeling program works is called finite element analysis. It has to divide the radiator, the conductor, into a whole bunch of tiny little triangles. As you make that radiator big in diameter, the number of triangles required starts going to infinity real fast. The computer program has to, by an iterative process, calculate exactly how much current and what phase angle of the voltage or what phase angle of the current exists on each one of those triangles. And if you've got thousands and thousands of those triangles, as a complex computer matrix, complex meaning that the value for each one of those triangles has a magnitude and a phase angle, and you've got to be doing a matrix inversion of that to carry on a number of the steps of the program. And so until every one of us has a real supercomputer in our pocket, the available computer hardware is not going to be able to handle that. I have seen people do computer modeling of very wide diameter radiators like that, and the computer modeling program takes 3 hours to make one set of calculations. I can hold my tuning tool near the antenna on the end of a wand. It's a piece of metal on the end of a wand, and I can make all those changes in 3 seconds. The computer modeling program takes 3 hours to find out what I just did. By by tinkering, I can find 100 different antennas in one day. The computer modeling program can model 2 or 3 of them if I know exactly how to put in the modeling program. So until we all have access to real good super programs, I'm not convinced that the modeling is going to catch up with us, if you know what I mean. We tinkerers, as ham radio operators, as antenna builders, in many cases, can do a better job. You might not quite agree with that, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Hi, K2LIW, K2EJ. Well, I can speed your argument down a couple places. In terms of, you know, how many multiplications can you do in a given period of time? And in today's world, that time keeps getting shorter and shorter and shorter. And we also have systems where instead of using one computer, you use a dozen or two dozen and share the workload amongst them. So that's not an impossibility, even though that you may have thousands of calculations on each point, which actually we have digital signal processors that do those kinds of arithmetic in incredible speeds compared to the typical computer that you use. And that's one thing. As you go on in time, yes, the tuning tool is really the ultimate thing, but the important part is to take the tuning tool and the piece of paper and make your recordings and make your record of data. And that data, which is done by us hams, will then lead the people who are modeling antennas, because we take that data and insert that into the modeling program. And as you know, many of the wonderful things we enjoy in electronics actually came from hams in the first place. So there you go. K2IW, K2J.
Yeah, in my opinion, the most reproduced piece of electronics I know of right now, and there's something like, 3 billion of them in use, cell phones. You take a country like Saudi Arabia or Russia, for reasons that are kind of strange, there are more cell phones in those countries than there are people. Right now in the United States, I think the cell phone ratio is about 95%. In other words, essentially every man, woman, and child has at least one cell phone. Boy, is that a reproduced piece of electronics. That is, from my point of view, a ham radio creation. By way of the so-called phone patching that we were doing with portable equipment way back in the late 50s, early 60s, that became a cell phone. The guy who really did most of the work developing the cell phone concept at Bell Laboratories was Dr. Reed Fisher, W2CQH. So what you call a cell phone, from my point of view, is a 95% ham radio creation, both in the original concept and the carrying out of producing the real hardware of the real cell phones. And that Mr. Cooper from Motorola, who when you go to Google and you ask who invented the cell phone, let me drop it, you get an answer of Mr. Cooper of Motorola. Yes, he made the first recognized cell phone call in front of a press conference with hardware that was developed by Motorola, following the concepts of Bell Laboratories and Reed Fisher. So he's given the credit, because he headed a crew of people that really installed the hardware in New York City that made that call. But the real concept and the original hardware came from W2CQH, an unsung hero, from my point of view. Okay, we got to move on. Bernie, we're going to put Bernie to sleep here. K2 Mike uniform. And that's a very nice set of pictures you've got on QRZ.com of your location there, Bernie. And you're up at a nice high altitude on an apartment building. And as long as your landlord will let you put up the right kind of an antenna, I think you can do beautiful things with stealthy antennas there. K2 Mike uniform, K2LIW. You got it, Bernie.
Okay, good evening, Dick. K2MU here. I don't need the landlord's permission. They don't know anything. They're all like 30-gauge wires by the side of the building, and I get out great in every direction but south. I even get out south occasionally. But, I have two questions. One is, I'm just curious. I've never quite understood the transition from transmitters that needed crystals on every frequency, like the old 2-meter radios or CB radios, or even ham radios that needed crystal control for every frequency. And then there was the was it frequency synthesis? I forgot what it's called exactly, but all of a sudden, one crystal, and you were good to go at all different frequencies. So if you could explain that, that would be really great. Second question is just a small one, is I do use antenna tuners exclusively here. I load up anything. When I was a kid, we used to load up ballpoint pens, believe it or not, and get them to transmit. Well, I have a little junky piece of Transmatch equipment here, and I was just wondering, the old Johnson matchbox, does that have a coaxial output as well as a balance line? And do you have any recommendations for a good, solid, heavy, old-timey matchbox that I can use for another few decades? And let me tune anything to anything, which is what I'm spoiled with. But more importantly is that first one, if you could explain, I think it's called frequency synthesis. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, Bernie. Back in the day, before you guys, most of us are listening to my voice, Eric and I and John, we remember the day when you picked up what looked like a handy talkie. In many cases, it was pretty bulky by modern standards. And if you wanted to talk to five different repeaters, you had to buy 10 crystals from International Crystal or somebody like that, Bailey, one of these crystal manufacturing companies. You needed a transmitting crystal and a receiving crystal for each one of those repeaters. So each one of us were very limited. And along comes this thing called a frequency synthesizer and or phase lock loop system, where one master oscillator on, say, 10 megahertz does all of that. And the way that system works is really a servo mechanism. You study the subject of servo mechanisms, you'll be amazed how extremely important they are to the operation of a human being, as well as the operation of a frequency synthesizer and a phase lock loop. What that thing does is it takes that master oscillator at 10 megs, and for everything to work out right, your particular oscillator may have to be on 10.000 megs if you don't want to be having a frequency error. It takes a 10 megacycle crystal, divides it down to some much lower number, maybe 100 kc. Let me drop. It takes the oscillator that's going to determine your frequency output, which is a kind of a free-running oscillator. It's not a crystal-controlled oscillator. It's a VCO, voltage-controlled oscillator. There are ways you can build an oscillator, an LC circuit oscillator, inductor capacitor oscillator circuit, where somewhere in there there's a variable capacitor. Usually it's a variable capacitance diode called varector diode. And that's part of the tuning network of that oscillator. You change the voltage on that diode, you go to a higher voltage, the capacitance goes down, you go to a lower voltage, the capacitance goes up. So by adjusting the voltage, up and down in voltage, the frequency coming out of that VCO, voltage-controlled oscillator, it goes up and down. So you can control the exact frequency of oscillation by giving it the right voltage. The next question is, how in the world does the system know what voltage to give it? Well, it takes the output of the voltage-controlled oscillator, and it also goes into a frequency divider. So you divide the frequency of the voltage-controlled oscillator output down to, let me pick a number, 100 kilohertz. Your 10 megacycle reference oscillator got to divide it down to 100 kilohertz also. The 200 kilohertzes from those two frequency dividers go into a voltage comparator, a phase comparator. It decides which one is higher and which one is lower, and it puts out either a higher or lower voltage accordingly in that comparator circuit. So it creates a command to the voltage control oscillator that says go up or go down until these 200 kc frequencies exactly match each other. Now, as long as you can control that divide ratio, the divider that's on the 100 kc, on the voltage control oscillator, if you can make it divide by 99, make it divide by 100, make it divide by 101, make it divide by 102, that's a simple digital circuit.
Repeater, timeout.
That commandable divide circuit that's dividing the frequency from the voltage-controlled oscillator is the thumbwheel switches we used to have on our frequency synthesizer. You are telling that circuit, divide now by 99, divide now by 100, divide now by 101. And the frequency gets readjusted accordingly. So it becomes all digital circuitry, per se, even though the output is an analog voltage on some very exact frequency. That phase lock loop servo mechanism that I'm describing is the so-called indirect method of frequency synthesis. They call it indirect because of all those feedback loops. There's also another kind of frequency synthesizer called a direct, where you start off with, again, a reference oscillator, and you put that into a comb generator. If, for instance, it was a 10-meg oscillator, the output of the comb generator would have comb lines at 100, 110, 120, 130. In other words, whatever your main input frequency is to that comb generator, it generates a whole lot of output lines simultaneously. It's a snap-action diode that's doing that. And now you've got another tune circuit in there that selects the particular comb line that you like today and mixes those comb lines together from a number of comb generators, and out comes the frequency. The nice thing about the direct frequency synthesizer, let me drop it. The direct frequency synthesizer can swish from frequency A to frequency B in microseconds, whereas the indirect frequency synthesizer, the phase lock loop system, it's going to take you a good number of milliseconds, a good fraction of a second, to arrive on the new frequency when you command a frequency change. And by the way, that frequency change does have to change on a modern-day handy-talkie. When you press the key to transmit, it goes to one phase lock frequency. When you release the key, it has to go to the receiver frequency. It has to generate the local oscillator in both cases with the right amount of offset. So when you go from the transmit mode to the receive mode on your handy-talkie, it probably takes, let me pick a number, 300 milliseconds, 500 milliseconds for that oscillator to arrive on the right frequency. Now you know one of the reasons why, if you're too quick on your handy-talkie, if you start talking while you're squeezing the handle, your first couple of words or first couple of syllables may not be there. You've got to squeeze the handle, wait till the phase lock loop arrives on frequency. Now the transmitter is enabled. Now you're really on the air, and hopefully you've done a little bit of delay between the time you squeeze and the time you start talking. Otherwise, people will miss the first couple of syllables of what you're saying. So I'm gonna put your second question in the queue, Bernie, and I'm gonna go on to the next person because I'm running a little bit late. And after we go on through the whole list, I'll come back to you. So I know you don't have the whole story on phase lock loop circuits, indirect frequency synthesizer and direct frequency synthesizer. You've only heard the tip of the iceberg, but you Google those words and you start reading. There's lots of good books on the subject, fascinating subject, and because of the accuracy of those circuits, you're able to listen to a thing called Voyager 8 billion miles away, three times the distance of Pluto. All of that.
Repeater, time out.
All of that becomes possible because of real good phase lock loop-like system, servo mechanism. K2 mic uniform, K2RIW. Go ahead, Bernie.
Okay, yeah, K2MU here. Yes, thank you for that. I got a lot of that. Of course, not all of it. But let me just as a quick follow-up, would it be correct in saying that the birth of this transition was made possible with the microprocessor, with the IC digital revolution, and would it be correct also in saying that the same is true to be said of the switching power supply? You had explained that a while back, and it sounds like this only happened because the IC came around and digital circuits came around. That's all as my follow-up, and thank you very much, K2MU.
Yes and no. Was it the microprocessor that enabled that? In the modern day radio, yes. In the beginning, no. Digital circuitry, yes. Ham radio wise, for all practical purposes, the birth of the frequency synthesizer was George L. Velke, the GLB synthesizer of roughly 1967 or so. George L. Velke, a real smart digital engineer in roughly Buffalo, New York, is where he lived. I wish I knew his call letters. He came out with a product called the GLB synthesizer. It was a box, and I own one of these things, about 2.5-3 inches high, about 5 inches wide, about 8 inches deep. And on the front are a bunch of thumb wheel switches, two sets of thumb wheel switches. One set of thumb wheel switches you set for the transmit frequency, and the other set you set for the receiver frequency. You bought that GLB synthesizer in 1967. It had an output of around 8 megahertz. One of the configurations for that thing. Let me drop. And you then took that cable and plugged it into the crystal socket of your 2-meter transceiver. Most 2-meter transceivers, most rigs in those days, used an 8 megacycle crystal and multiplied it up to whatever frequency you were on. 6 meters, 2 meters, 220, and so on. So you took the output of this GLB box with roughly 8 megs, very precise 8 megs that could be tunable by way of those thumb wheel switches, and those thumb wheel switches were setting the divide circuit that told the phase lock loop what divide of the frequency of the voltage controlled oscillator running near 8 megs. And then you plugged that into the 8 meg crystal, and now instead of buying 10 crystals to be on 5 separate repeater bands, repeater frequencies, that GLB gave you all 800 megahertz, all 800 frequencies that you could select on the 2-meter band, every 10 kc, 15 kc, whatever it was. So in other words, you didn't have to buy crystals anymore. And boy, that was very popular in its day. I wonder, Eric, if you ever owned a GLB synthesizer. You and I go back to the same time. I'm going to ask John the same question. KE2EJ, KQRIW in the TechNet.
KQRIW, KE2EJ. Well, when I saw that, I got a schematic of it. Built my own. Funny. By the way, you did leave out today's most important synthesizer, and that's a DDS, a direct digital synthesis, and that's basically a ROM that has a sine wave in it, and you just simply clock it out at different rates. They make different frequencies. KQRIW, KE2EJ.
You're absolutely right. So when it comes to direct frequency synthesis, by way of the comb lines is the way that was popular, let's pick a number, 15, 20 years ago. And now with the DDS, direct digital synthesizer, what that circuit does is it takes the sine wave you want to generate of, let's say, 146 megacycle output. That's really a sine wave. It breaks it up into, let me pick a number, 1,024 individual steps. And so this circuit goes through each one of those steps. And if those steps are fine enough and you get the right kind of a filter output, even though it's really done in discrete steps across that 360 degrees of one sine wave, as long as those steps are small enough and you properly filter them, you think you've generated a pure sine wave. In reality, you've generated a whole lot of digital steps. And now you change the rate at which you go through those steps as a way of deciding what frequency you're going to get output. That's called direct digital synthesis. And yes, modern-day digital circuits do that beautifully. And in order to do all the functions you like correctly to switch the frequency between transmit and receive, nowadays you do use a microprocessor, but you didn't have to. So when it comes to the GLB synthesizer, which wasn't a very expensive circuit, sold in kit form as well as thoroughly built up. Let me drop. The Eric I know had the resources to go out and buy the real GLB. But he was challenged by the way that worked, and he wanted to build his own version, and he built his own. And I wonder, John, if you ever owned a GLB synthesizer. KC2WGB, KQRIW, go ahead, John.
Yes, I did, Dick. Interesting item. Worked very well. Was very stable. It had those BCD thumb wheel switches on it, just like you described. But mine was a lot larger than one that you had. I don't know, maybe it was an earlier version. But quite a few people use those, and did save a lot of bucks in crystals.
And all I've got to do is go out to my basement, where I've got my GLB synthesizer sitting on the shelf, and you're probably right. My nostalgia tells me what size and inches I just gave you guys, and I'm probably wrong. Very similar to what happened when I went back 30 years later and visited the house that I grew up in. I said, my goodness, is that house small. It was real big when I was there. It's lousy memory. Now, the one thing wrong with the GLB synthesizer is it did not have TL tone capability. And when you you added the, as various repeaters started requiring a PL tone, and you have this GLB synthesizer, somebody came up with a couple of add-on circuits that would give it PL capability. Well, you had to be very, very careful in the way you shielded the various stages so that that PL tone generator didn't create grief. And I had to do a whole lot of work on my GLB synthesizer to make sure the cover really made tight contact around all the edges so that it was well shielded from the transmitter. If the power output from your transmitter got fed back to the GLB synthesizer, that in turn was enough RF energy to hit the individual integrated circuits, your 5400 NAND gates and whatever, and the voltage, the RF voltage got rectified by those NAND gates. Let me drop. The rectified voltage on the NAND gates offset their bias voltage, which offset their timing of when they switch from the 0 to the 1 mode. And that offset of timing made a funny kind of a feedback that made the PL tone generator on the GLB synthesizer not work correctly unless the synthesizer was extremely well shielded from your transmitter. And that required some heroics to know to make that work. So that was a beautiful circuit. We got to go on. Lance is the next guy. We got to wait a little bit longer to make sure Lance comes through. KF7, Victor November Hotel. Go right ahead with your question, Lance. Way out there, and I think you're in Reno. KF7, VNH, K2RIW. You got it, Lance.
Yes, sir. This is KF7. KF7BNH. And my question was, and you've covered a lot of good antenna subjects there, as well as oscillators, thank you. But anyway, my question was, on the log periodics, what do they give up for being so simple and duplexing? How much do they give up by not requiring that duplexing? Just by being a simple antenna with one simple feed line. Over.
You could say a log periodic antenna, Lance, is the Yagi equivalent of a fan dipole. In the case of a fan dipole, you've got a whole lot of individual dipoles all running to a common feed point at the center, and they're all fanned out from each other. And the more you fan them out, the less is the interaction between them. And it makes tuning a little bit easier. Okay? You lay it out as a flat object on a sheet of paper, so to speak. You call it a fan dipole. You lay it out in a Yagi-like structure with a zigzag feeding arrangement between the two, and we call it a log periodic Yagi. The sharp point is where you feed the signal into the log periodic. The signal goes down that zigzag transmission line down the center until it hits a set of dipoles that resonate. All the dipoles that it hits in the beginning are too short. They're essentially an open circuit. They don't do anything. All the dipoles that are way at the back that are too big, they're out of resonance. They don't suck up any of the signal. Only the ones in the middle, so to speak, on your particular operating frequency are near resonance, and they start sucking up the signal. And because of the way it works, where you're going to hit the shorter dipoles first and the middle and the exact resonant frequency a little bit later, and the next one that's a little bit too long later, you're really feeding it like a Yagi. You're giving it the right phase angle, the right amplitude, the right ones light up at the right time. And so, once again, it's a beautiful demonstration. Let me drop. It's a beautiful demonstration of you resonate first, then it will radiate. The cell within the log periodic that is resonant at your frequency are the ones that will suck up the signal and radiate. And because of the way you set it up, the shorter one gets an advanced phase because it gets the signal earlier. The longer ones get the signal later. That's exactly what you want to do with a Yagi. You feed the right amplitude at the right phase angle between the elements, and you have a Yagi-like structure. The good news about a log periodic is properly designed, they can cover tremendous range of frequency. 3-to-1 is easy, 10-to-1 is possible, 100-to-1 is remotely possible, with a very well-designed log periodic. Very large frequency regions between the lowest and the highest can be handled with a log periodic. Let me drop.